Hey, Rav Tov, everyone. Good evening. Welcome to Beit Emmanuel Torah Tuesday. This is the week of Parashat Vayeshev, which covers Genesis 37, verse 1, and goes through chapter 40, verse 23. It's rather a lengthy, kind of dense portion. It's the ninth portion of the Torah cycle, and the ninth section of the book of Bereshit, Genesis. But before we get started with Vayeshev, just a reminder about the Hanukkah Shabbat, a week from this coming Friday, December 11th, that we'll be having at Murray Family Church at 6:30. The sign-ups by the coffee and the snacks. So please let us know how many are coming, and if you can bring something, it's a potluck. And so that is coming up. Again, Murray Family Church is the location. It won't be here at Beit Emmanuel, but be downtown, 6:30, December 11th. And also, pardon the dust, they were in here sanding today, and we tried to clean up as best we could, but dust just keeps settling. So it'll probably be that way for about another month around here, but hopefully things will change. Let's get started with the blessing before the study of Torah. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Asher Kidishanu Bo Mitzvotav Vesivanu Le'asok B'Divrei Torah. Blessed are you, Lord God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us with his commandments and has commanded us to be immersed in the words and the matters of Torah. Amen. As we do in the Torah Sparks series, we begin with a nugget from Rabbi Abraham Twersky. And since Hanukkah is coming upon us, I thought we would focus a little bit on Hanukkah. And for those who do light the Hanukkiah for the 8 days of Hanukkah, we'll look at about why that is the way it is. So in the Talmud, in Tractate Shabbat, folio 21b, it says, Hillel says, on the first day of Hanukkah, one candle shall be lit. Each subsequent night, one candle is added, so that on the eighth night, there are eight lights. So why not light all eight candles every night? Hillel teaches us two things. First, we must always seek to increase our enlightenment and not be stagnant. We should never be satisfied with whatever spiritual growth we have achieved today, but should constantly seek to further our growth. Secondly, it is a mistake to grasp too much too fast. Spiritual growth should be gradual, and we should adapt ourselves to each new level and integrate what we have achieved before going on to the next step. Overreaching can cause us to be top-heavy, and our spirituality may be tenuous at best. Gradual growth provides us with a firm foundation. Eight lights on the first night? That would be too much and too soon. And each night thereafter would be no different and show no increase in light. Mm-hmm. Then, love your neighbor, as we take seriously our words, the words of our Messiah, Yeshua HaNotzri, when asked what was the most important commandment. And he said to love God and to love your neighbor as yourself, and that all the Torah and the prophets, which for him was the Bible. But the whole Bible hinges on this concept, love God and love your neighbor. And so we take that to, and understand that to mean, if everything hinges on it, then everything must somehow be about that and relate to it. So each week we take a little bit of time to look at a few ways in which that particular portion of the Torah is teaching us how to love our neighbor as ourselves. It's not an exhaustive list from each portion. I usually just try to take two or three just to kind of get our minds thinking that way. Genesis 37, verse 3. It says, Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a robe of many colors. The Talmud actually uses this verse, Genesis 37, verse 3, to comment on the fact that parents should not favor one child over another. Because of the many-colored coat that Jacob gave to Joseph, and that he did not give to any of his other sons, Joseph's brothers became jealous of him. And they began to resent him and resent Joseph and everything Joseph said and did. The eventual outcome of this jealousy was that the whole family and even the following generations went down into Egypt and were enslaved. Parents should be on high alert that their actions not cause jealousy. And you can even expand this beyond the parent-child relationship. We should be careful in all our actions in dealing with people that we don't cause jealousy. Right? Sometimes it's still going to happen, but we need to be aware and sensitive to how we treat people and if it will cause jealousy in others. The consequences of jealousy among siblings or among others within a community can be tragic. Statements like, why don't you get good grades like your brother? Or why aren't you as well behaved as your sister? Are bound to create ill feelings. And jealousy and jealous feelings may not always be visible. You may think, oh no, it's not doing that with my children. But we still must be conscious about if we are causing those feelings. So we love our neighbor and we love our kids when we do not create or cause jealousy. Or at least we are conscious of how we are treating others so that we do not inadvertently create jealousy. Genesis chapter 40, verses 6 and 7. When Joseph came to them in the morning, he saw that they were troubled. And that's the two in prison with him. And so he asked Pharaoh's officers, who were with him in custody in his master's house, why are your faces downcast today? So when Joseph notices that Pharaoh's officials were dejected, he takes the time to ask them, what is the reason? What's the cause? Why are they feeling this way? Now, if you think about it, Joseph had very good reason to keep to himself and to consider his own welfare. After all, he's been imprisoned himself under a false accusation by Potiphar's wife. And so you would think, well, you know, probably when you are in prison, it's best just to kind of keep to yourself and mind your own business and worry about your own affairs. And certainly no one would have blamed Joseph if he would have cared less about how the guys in the next cell block were doing or feeling. No one would blame him. But nevertheless, Joseph shows that he cares about his fellow human being enough that when he sees someone with a problem, that he's actually eager to help, that he's eager to offer some assistance. Our good friend, the Chofetz Chaim, writes that although it is usually the best policy to speak as little as possible, because the less you speak, the less likely it is that you're going to put your foot in your mouth. So the Chofetz Chaim says the best policy is really to speak as little as possible. He says, however, it is a moral obligation. It is a Torah principle to boost the spirits of someone who is dejected by being willing to converse with them at length if necessary. So the Chofetz Chaim, who says, the one who is all about guarding speech, says, look, ideas really don't speak much at all. However, you are obligated to speak even at length if you see your fellow human being being despondent or dejected. At the very least, you were to ask, what's the problem? Or how can I help? Or is there something I can do? And so we love our neighbor when we see a need, such as someone being despondent, and we are willing to engage them and, if at all possible, cheer them up. Right? And then the third one, I'm actually going to save to later because I want to pair it with what I'm going to talk about right after it, about being willing to sacrifice rather than publicly shame someone. This is going to be looking at the incident of Tamar and her father-in-law, Yehuda, Judah. And so I want to pair those two together because, as I think I mentioned in our last class together, one of the fundamental principles of a Hebraic mindset is to always try to look for the positive spin on something, to interpret something in the positive light, to understand someone's actions in a positive way, even if they are the so-called villain of the story. Okay? And this is another case of doing that, because it's easy for us to begin to think Judah is this horrible guy, but we're going to find out maybe that's not not the whole side of the story. Does he make a mistake? Of course he does. But it's so I want to pair those two together. So we'll come back to this third way to love our neighbor as ourself. So let's get into the text. Since it is, as I said, a pretty lengthy text, a lengthy portion for this week, and quite dense, a lot to get to, so I would encourage listening to the archives because there's a lot of stuff we won't even touch tonight, but we have touched in previous years. But being that it is the type of portion it is, I thought a good summary of it would help us. A little summary with a little commentary, just in case you haven't read the portion before class or haven't finished reading it. One of my practices is, while I do read it before class, to prepare, I also read just, I divide it into sevenths, and I read a small section every day for more in-depth study. So if you do that, I want to make sure we get the whole kind of picture of the parashat. So the name of this parashat, Vayishev, in Hebrew means, and he dwelt. And it's specifically referring to how Jacob wanted to dwell in peace and tranquility in the land of Israel, in the land of Canaan. Having overcome the challenges posed by Laban and Esau and the inhabitants of Shechem, where he had that incident where they violated his daughter, and then his two sons decide to take Simon and Levi, take revenge, and there's bloodshed, and Jacob's name is tarnished. He's gotten through a whole bunch of stuff in his lifetime. I mean, we've been studying Jacob's life up to this point, and it's filled with adventure, it's filled with difficulty, ups and downs. And now, as he's coming towards his end, he's basically saying he just wants to dwell. He just wants to dwell in the land of his fathers. He just wants to settle it down. And so the parashat begins with the description of the rivalry between Jacob's designated heir, Joseph. That's his firstborn. That's something we've talked about in previous Torah classes, in previous years. The scriptures have this unique way of helping us understand that firstborn really doesn't have to do with birth order, right? It has to do with the scandal of particularity, is what the theological term is. In other words, the choosing of the father, the choosing of God, right? And so Joseph is the baby of the family, but he's been designated by Jacob to be his heir, to be the firstborn. And so it opens by describing this rivalry between Joseph and his brothers. On the one hand, Jacob does this because he recognizes Joseph's superior spiritual qualities that made him uniquely suited to steward the family as it would begin its transformation from a bunch of individuals and a group of sons into a community and ultimately into a nation. But on the other hand, Jacob's other sons were acutely aware of how Abraham and Isaac had overestimated the potentials of their sons Ishmael and Esau, and they were afraid of history repeating itself. And for good reason. Up until this point, with all of the patriarchs, history really does repeat itself, right? I mean, many of the things that happened in Abraham's life, including his foibles, happens in Isaac's life, happens in Jacob's life. And so the other brothers are like, look, Abraham kind of got it wrong with Ishmael, you know, Isaac kind of got it wrong with Esau, maybe dad's got it wrong with Joseph, right? Now, there's quite a bit in the background, and I'm going to hold it off until next year's Torah class, about the brothers, that they actually were responding from an appropriate point of view. From a very, if you will, Torah-based point of view of protection and so forth, that they weren't these roughen rebels and so forth. They had a reason. They had a pretty good reason. And it's this battle between essentially Judah and Joseph, okay, that will be carried throughout all of Scripture, okay? But for now, just know that the brothers, they've observed and they understand the fractal nature of things, okay? And maybe since the granddad and dad got it wrong, with their choosing. Yeah. So when Joseph then goes to his brothers and he tells them about his two dreams, and the dreams, of course, he's not only the leader of the family, but he's almost of God status, where they bow down and worship him. They were alarmed by his exhibition of conceit. And there actually is good reason for that. The sages have always taught, tradition has always taught, that Joseph, while incredibly gifted spiritually, was indeed a righteous tzaddik, a foreshadow of the Messiah himself, which we've talked about in previous Torah years, that starting off when he was young, he was quite arrogant and conceited. And you can see that in the Torah if you have eyes to look at it. He's kind of like the Sheldon of Big Bang Theory, right? If you've ever watched that. Sheldon's the genius, but part of the issue is Sheldon knows he's the genius, right? And so he tends to be pejorative in his correcting of people and comes off very arrogant. Joseph had a little bit of that in his youth because of how much potential he was already actualizing. All right, and so they see this conceit and they begin to wonder, is this befitting for a future leader of God's nation? They therefore contrived a plan to put him in mortal danger, leaving it up to God to decide his fate, right? And at this point, Jacob's fourth son, who has assumed the leadership mantle among the other brothers, because the true firstborn in chronological order, Reuben, why is he not their leader? Yeah, because he messed around and he if you remember from previous years, it's not that he slept, had sexual intercourse with his father's wife. It's that he was protecting the honor of his mother who had passed away, because he was saying, you loved Rachel more than my mom. And now that Rachel has passed on, you should be moving into my mom's home. But instead, you moved into her home. So he moved her bed. So he moved Jacob. He was rearranging family quarters. But nonetheless, that removes him from leadership. Second and third in charge are Shimon and Levi. Why are they not two and three now? Because of the bloodshed that they did in Shechem. And as they kind of show here, they're still kind of prone to that kind of temperament. Right? And so Judah is the next up. And so the brothers recognize Judah as their leader. So if you want to think of them as a gang or a group that hangs out, Judah is the one whom they listen to. Judah is the one whom they give their respect to. He's also been singled out by Jacob for leadership qualities and for leadership, but not on quite the same level as Joseph. And so you have this rivalry between Joseph and Judah that will continue in the next several portions coming up. So he comes and he proposes that they instead sell Joseph as a slave. This then would neutralize Joseph and also leave them kind of innocent or not culpable for killing him, because they just sold him into slavery and they don't know what happens to him. So Judah's way of kind of compromising. Well, let's not kill him and let's not kind of just abandon him to the scorpions in the pit without water. That's very highly symbolic, by the way. But let's not do that. Let's sell him into slavery and be done with it. The brothers agree. Joseph sold as a slave. Nonetheless, they still tried to influence Jacob to abandon his plans for Joseph as the next leader. They didn't want Jacob to keep thinking, well, Joseph will be coming back any day now. So they trick Joseph into thinking that he's been killed by a wild animal. Now, this is very important for a little bit later on this evening. Remember the portion reading? How did they tell Jacob that Joseph has been eaten by wild animals? Does anyone remember that? They take his garment, and who takes the garment? Well, you check that out. Takes the garment, and then what do they ask Jacob? Do you recognize this, right? Do you recognize this? Whose is this? Okay? Keep that in mind, okay? This is Judah's plan. Judah's essentially saying, ask Father whose garment this is, okay? With that, Jacob is convinced Joseph's dead. So he mourns Joseph's death continuously. Instead of grieving him for a short period of time for Shiva and then moving on, which is what his brothers had hoped for. So the brothers then blame Judah. They blame Judah for their father's inconsolable mourning, pointing out that, hey, you're the leader, and if you would have just suggested that we abandon the plan altogether, instead of convincing us to sell Joseph, or to, instead of killing him, we would have listened to you. You're our leader, so it's really all on you. All right? So shunned by his brothers, Judah leaves the family, and he goes into business with someone from a neighboring village. Eventually, he marries, and he has three sons. When the oldest came of age, Judah found a wife for him by the name of Tamar. When the first son died, Judah had Tamar marry his second son. Now, this is an important concept, because why does he have the second son marry Tamar? Levirate marriage? That's the correct answer, but what's the problem with that? Or what's the problem with it if you don't believe in an oral Torah? What's the problem with that? There is no Levirate marriage yet, right? There is no priesthood in any of that stuff yet. Sinai hasn't happened. None of that's been instituted yet. So how does he know to do that? It's the oral tradition, right? Passed on from Abraham and from that, from Shem and Aver and so forth, right? So there's kind of an intertextual showing there that there was an oral tradition about Levirate marriage. So he gives his second son to Tamar because then Tamar can supposedly have a child, carry on the family name, but this second son also dies. And Tamar expected Judah to have her marry his third and final son. But Judah, who was unaware that his first two sons died on account of their own sinful behavior, was afraid that his third son would die after marrying Tamar, just as his first two sons had. And in some ways, who can blame him, right? If you don't know the whole story, all you know is, I picked you out for my first son, he died. I gave you my second son, he died. I only got one son left. I'm not giving him to you, right? That's Judah's behavior. So Judah makes excuses to Tamar, which she knew were just excuses, and she saw through it. She was anxious to be the mother of Judah's progeny no matter what. This is a streak of holiness in Tamar. She is just like the other great matriarchs. She knows somehow in the spirit knows Messiah is through her line. And so she's the same way with how you understand Lot's daughters from a proper point of view. When they do an improper act, it's their motivation that actually was pure and holy. And we've talked about that in previous classes. So she has a pure motive. And what she does is she disguises herself as a prostitute after Judah's wife has died. And she seduces Judah. She thus becomes the mother of twins, Judah's fourth and fifth sons, Perez and Zerach, which is significant because the Gospel of Matthew, Gospel of Matthew, tells us that one of Yeshua's ancestors is not only Yehuda, Judah, but his son, Perez, right? So Messiah comes through this lineage, and the fact that it comes from a somewhat scandalous affair, if you will, is also instructive, okay? So in the meantime, while all of that's going on, Joseph has been sold to Potiphar, who was an executive to the Egyptian pharaoh. Potiphar readily recognizes Joseph's leadership capabilities, just as Jacob did, and he puts him in charge of his household. Once Joseph is there and established, Potiphar's wife begins making overtures to him. Now, there is a deeper spiritual thing going on with what Joseph and Potiphar's wife are seeking to accomplish, but we'll stay on the Peshat for right now. So she makes overtures to him, eventually tries to seduce him when everyone's gone. Joseph is able to resist this. We'll talk about how he was able to resist this a little bit later. Frustrated at the rejection, Potiphar's wife frames him as having tried to seduce her, and as a result, Joseph's put back in jail. Just as he was in Potiphar's house, Joseph in jail quickly shows himself to be a leader, trusted, and he's given responsibility and leadership within the prison. He's put in charge of all the inmates. In this capacity, he notices two recently incarcerated inmates. One is the Pharaoh's cupbearer, who is the one who would taste the Pharaoh's food to make sure it wasn't poisoned, to make sure it was to the Pharaoh's specification, that it met the dietary laws that the Egyptians had. Egyptian kosher, if you will. Everything was the way it was supposed to be, that it was prepared correctly, both ceremonially as well as to his personal taste. And again, chiefly, if there were dignitaries or whatever, he would be the one that would find out if the wine had been poisoned and so forth. And then the other one was Pharaoh's baker. They were both troubled by something, so Joseph makes an inquiry. They tell them about their dreams, which Joseph then interprets correctly to mean the cupbearer would be restored to his position, but the baker would be executed. Joseph then asked the cupbearer, "Please remember me." It's a pertinent verbal tally. "Please remember me and plead my case before Pharaoh when you are freed." But of course, the cupbearer forgets about Joseph at least for a long while after he leaves prison. And the events of this week's parashat seem to be the very antithesis of the way it starts, with Jacob wanting peace and just to dwell in the land of my fathers. Seems to be the opposite of this peace and tranquility that Jacob sought, and for why the portion is given its name. However, as we hopefully will see as the narrative unfolds, especially even in the coming weeks, through the threads of Joseph and Judah's lives, how they are tied together, the events of this portion will indeed lead, when all is said and done and in the final analysis, to the tranquility that Jacob was looking for, both in his own life and in the collective destiny of God's people. Right? So that's the parashat. That's the portion. Right? So now let's look at some specific verses and see what they have to offer us, especially as they are applicable to us today. Don't run from your troubles. Genesis 37, verse 1, the opening pasuk, the opening verse of the portion, says, Jacob settled in the land, or dwelt in the land, vayeshev, in the land of his father's sojournings. Right? So it's the idea that after all that he's been through, he's come back to dwell, right? To dwell. Now, regarding this verse, the Baal HaTarim writes this. This is a really interesting comment on this verse, and we're going to kind of unpack it. We're going to take it from the Baal HaTarim. He says this, quote, on Genesis 37, verse 1, the first part. "This can be compared to one who, upon seeing a band of dogs beginning to chase him and intent on attacking him, decides to sit himself down among the dogs. So too, Jacob, settled among Esau's descendants." Right? Because the land of his father's sojournings is also the land of Esau's sojournings, right? So, let's unpack a little bit about why this particular rabbi, Baal HaTarim, would say this. The Gera Rebbe also derives from this verse a significant lesson regarding life and how life should be lived. At times in our lives when we are confronted with various trials and tribulations, anxieties and misfortunes, challenges, things that are uncomfortable for us, things that we would rather not go through, rather not face, rather not endure, one of our first reactions may be to simply run from it, right? Just kind of turn the other direction. Avoid it. Avoidance, right? We want to put it in psychological terms, which is what a lot of what we're doing in Torah Sparks. It's avoidance, right? You don't want to deal with the conflict you have with your dad or your mother or your spouse or your children or your friends or your coworker. You avoid it, right? You run from it. Consequently, much of what is good in your life such as your relationships, your relationship to God, to your Messiah, that will wane and falter. If you've ever avoided something, you will know that your avoidance of dealing with your parents will spill over into your marriage. And then that will spill over into your relationship with your kids, and then that will spill over their relationship with you and how they view their grandparents. In other words, it causes a bigger mess, right? When you run from it, it causes a bigger problem. When we run from troubles, when we run from things we would just assume not deal with, when we run from conflict, the idea is that they're going to continue to chase you. And in fact, the running around and the chasing will wreak havoc in your life, and eventually can cause great depression and angst, both on an emotional level, but also on a spiritual level. It'll clog you up spiritually. If you think not talking to your sibling for 12 years isn't going to affect any other part of your life, you're crazy. It will. It's going to. It's gonna chase you around, right? That whole issue is going to chase you wherever you go. So, Jacob does not have this response to issues like this, right? He confronts Esau, he confronts Laban, he deals with the issue at Shechem. He confronts his challenges head on, not allowing them to affect his spiritual and emotional well-being. And Joseph follows in his father's footsteps. While incarcerated in the miserable Egyptian prison, Joseph does not let depression rule his life, right? He doesn't say, woe is me. Now, certainly, we know Joseph was human. So, at some point in his mind, did he ever say, cursed my brothers? Probably. Yeah, sure. Did he ever at night when he laid down in the cold cell or whatever, think what could have been, what should have been, all that? Probably. But he doesn't let it consume him. He doesn't let it overrun him, right? He is able to deal with it because he confronts it. His smile, his kind words, he's full of simcha. He knows how to be like as Shaul, to be content wherever he's at, whether it's in prison or whether it's not, much like Shaul. His smile, his kind words, they became a staple for many of the prisoners around him. And he never forgot Hashem. He never forgot God. The Torah reminds us of that time and time again. He never forgot the ways of his father. During his most trying moments, he attempted to live his life as ordinary as he could, as spiritual as he could, never deviating from his spiritual upbringing, his spiritual status quo. This is the meaning that the Baal HaTorim gives in his analogy, that if a person is confronted by a band of dogs that are bent on harming him, running away from the dogs will only do what for the dogs? Encourage them to run faster, right? And rev them up. Right? So if you think the best way to deal with the Yetzer Hara, and the voice in your head, and the adversaries in your life, if the best way is to run from them, all you're doing is strengthening them. Right? You're making their teeth snarl, you're getting them excited. This is what they want. This is what the Yetzer wants. Okay? They're going to pick up chase all the more and go after. The best plan is to remain stationary in order to confront the challenge with determination and fortitude. Now, I don't know if you remember, several years ago, there was a popular, handbook that was sold. It was yellow. It was, 100 pages. It was basically how to survive anything. It had, how to survive a plane crash, how to survive, it had, 100 things. How to survive, and the idea was it was small and it was waterproof and all that. You just kept it with you wherever so that if you found yourself in a car that ran off a bridge into water and how do you get out of the car? It was all in there. You pull that out of the glove compartment and look it up while you're sinking into the water. But one of the things was, what do you do if you're out in the woods enjoying yourself and a bear's in your path? All right? They said the first thing not to do is don't run. The best thing to do is stand there and even be aggressive toward the bear. Because the bear is usually thinking, I'm the biggest, baddest thing around. Everybody's scared of me. When it encounters something that doesn't run from it, it scatters his brain. Hey, wait a second. This thing isn't running from me and it's not scared. In fact, I don't know what it is and now it's after me. And it will take off. That was that guidebook's solution was either be still or actually go on the aggressive, pop it in the nose, things like that. Okay? That's kind of what the Baal HaTorim's taking from Genesis 37, verse 1. Harav Yechum Levovitz also takes a similar approach in this understanding about Jacob's decision to settle in Esau's backyard. He uses the following analogy to make his point. Again, this is from Harav Levovitz. Quote, "Once an elderly woman remained sipping her coffee in the restaurant of a theater, long after the curtain had gone up, signaling the beginning of the first act. The waiter inquired curiously why she had not taken a seat in the theater. And she replied, 'I would never go in now. It's much too crowded. I will go in once they all come out. Then I can have as many seats as I want to myself.'" Now, of course, this is the folly of life, believe it or not, for many of us. We wait for those tranquil moments, those endless summer days, when the sky is blue and cloudless, the sun is warm and shining, and everything seems to be perfect. And when the rain falls, which is just a temporary situation that we have to endure, we perceive it to be a hardship. We consider it a painful interlude, assuming that when it's all over, we will resume our real life. But this perspective on life is false. Many fail to realize that life actually is all about the rain and the storms and the thunder and the lightning. A part of life is the sickness and the anxiety that we must face, the pain and the fear, and our constant striving to overcome these challenges through our connection to Messiah. Only through these tribulations, and only through our triumph by God's grace with His assistance, are we able to enhance our spirituality in order to fulfill our purpose in this world. Remember the way back in previous Torah classes when we talked about why did the children of Israel have to go in and take the land themselves? They were living this purely spiritual existence, eating heavenly food, never closed in wear on 40 years, never had an injury in 40 years, didn't poop or pee for 40 years, nothing. Everything was perfect. So why did they have to take the land? So they wouldn't be spiritual trust fund babies, right? So they wouldn't assume that it was owed to them, so that they would appreciate it, understand their role in this world, to elevate the mundane, to be a light to the nations, that the land would be the beacon that would draw all nations to it, that they would be part of this great mission of making this earth God's dwelling place, of making it holy once again, of bringing the kingdom to this earth, right? That they would be partners with God in this creation. And the only way they could do that is if they toiled for their food instead of having it pop up in the morning and what they didn't eat just disappeared, right? And always having the right amount of this and the right amount of that, right? Same thing with what goes on in our life. Emunah. Emunah tells us that everything is for our own good, for our own relationship to Hashem, because He loves us, because He's maturing us. He's bringing us where we need to be. Okay? It's so all of these challenges are important for us. The sunny days, and they're good and they're great and we should rejoice in them, that's the time to gather our strength and to conjure up our courage to be able to derive the most from when life challenges hit. True, Jacob sought tranquility and he desired serenity in his old days. He did not seek it, however, for the purpose of leisure, to simply idle his time away. Okay, you may retire from work or your vocation or your occupation, but you don't get to retire from your service to Hashem. You don't get to retire from your worship of Hashem. You don't get to retire from these connections. Jacob isn't seeking to simply have leisure time, right? Instead, Jacob is seeking peace of mind so that he could better devote himself to his spiritual pursuits. This world is for action. It's for challenge. It's for ascending the ladder of spiritual maturity. Those who focus simply on the intermissions will find themselves missing the show. Jacob and Joseph, preparing to live in an alien environment. Genesis 37, verse 3. This is an interesting verse, and this is the beauty of how the sages interpret the scriptures, right? And how they they catch phrases that they're there. They're still there even in English once you hear them, that we just gloss over because we just assume we're so smart and got it figured out. Genesis 37, verse 3. Israel loved Joseph more than all of his other sons because he was a child of his old age. Who's the his? Is it Jacob? That's not how the sages interpret it. Our good friends, the Targums. Remember the Targums? We haven't hung out with the Targums in a while. Targums are our great friends. What are the Targums? They're mostly Aramaic. They do come in some other languages, but they are mostly Aramaic paraphrases, not translations, paraphrases of the Torah text. It was used starting maybe 100 years before the time of Yeshua, used during the time of Yeshua, and during the time of the apostles. In the synagogues for the Torah reading, they would read it in Hebrew, or they would sing it in Hebrew, but because of the diaspora, not everyone spoke Hebrew very well. I mean, most of them had adopted the Aramaic dialect because of Aramaic, Chaldean, Assyrian, all the same thing, by the way, is the language of the captivity. And so a lot of them kept that when they came back with Ezra and Nehemiah and so forth. And so after the Torah was sung in its original Hebrew from the scroll, someone would in Aramaic summarize what was just read. Why that's important for us is because the summary obviously includes interpretation. And why that's important for us as followers of Yeshua, the Messiah, is because these are the interpretations Yeshua heard in the synagogue. These are the interpretations the apostles heard in the synagogue. These are the interpretations that they understood about the Torah passages. Okay? So in the Targums, in Onkelos' Targum, he translates the Hebrew that gets translated as he was a child of his old age as, quote, a child of his, or he translates a child of his old age as, quote, a wise child. In other words, he understands the his as Joseph. So that even as a young child, Joseph was wise as if he was in his old years. That's how the Targums understood it. So when Yeshua was in synagogue, when Shaul or Yochanan or Shimon Kefa, when they were in synagogue and they heard Genesis 37 read and they heard the paraphrase, they heard it as Israel loved Joseph more than all of his other sons because he was wise as an old guy, even though he was a kid. Okay. Rashi in your Chumash, if you have a Chumash, explains the choice when he cites a Midrash that states that Jacob transmitted to Joseph all that he had learned in the academy of Shem and Eber. Shem and Eber, who are these cats? Who's Shem? Shem is who? Son of Noah. And Eber is? His son. Or depending on how some translations, his grandson. But somewhere in this lineage, Shem and Eber. The tradition is that Shem and Eber, like, live forever. I mean, they just live, they're old guys. All right? And they have a little cave in the Galilee in a town that's known as Sfat. And if you go to Sfat, even to today, you can go to the cave of Shem and Eber. All right? And there is a Beit Midrash there where they study the Torah there every day. The idea is that they took the wisdom from Noah, and they taught all the generation. That's where Abraham, when he became aware of the one God and all that, he went and sought out Shem and Eber. Right? So Shem and Eber had their kind of own seminary, their own Torah school in the Galilee, up on the high mountain of Sfat. And the tradition that Rashi cites is that Jacob transmitted everything he learned from Shem and Eber to Joseph. The Torah describes Jacob as being a wholesome man abiding in tents, Genesis 25:27, meaning that he was a scholar from the moment that he matured. Now, Jacob would have certainly received a lot of teaching from Isaac and Abraham, But the Midrash specifies that what he transmitted to Joseph was not what he learned from Isaac and Abraham, but that was that what he learned from Shem and Aver. Okay? Rabbi Yechiel Meir of Ostrovska cites this Midrash when he says, Rebekah sent Jacob away to Laban. Remember that in the Torah reading? That Jacob spent 14 years at the academy of Shem and Aver before he went to Haran, as his mother had instructed him. Now, before you totally dismiss that, where in your apostolic writings have you had someone spend 14 years preparing for something? Yeah, Shaul, right? So, before you kind of dismiss the tradition, it finds its way in your apostolic writings, right? And 14 is significant because it's 4 cycles of 3.5, right? And that's, and the 4 cycles go through Peshat, Remez, Darash, Sod of the truth. And it takes you 14 years to go through this stuff. It's traditional that it usually takes 14 years to become a rabbi because you have to go through these cycles. Because of the modern world, you can do it in about 7 now. They make you kind of, they short trunk it, okay? As everything in our society is done. But so that he spent 14 years up in Tzfat with Shem and Aver. Jacob did this, the Midrash says, because he felt that the teaching he had received from his fathers, Isaac and Abraham, was inadequate because it did not tell him how to conduct himself in an indecent environment. It only taught him how to conduct himself in a decent environment when he was in the presence of Abraham, Isaac, and Rebekah. You kind of relate to this. It's kind of if you raise your children in a bubble and you only expose them to your world and your worldviews and everything about you, that's great as long as the rest of their life they live in that bubble. But when they get out of that bubble, when you pass away and they're all on their own, they may not be prepared to face things that they've never seen before or heard before or experienced before, because it's now a completely alien, godless environment. And they've always thought, well, doesn't everybody do this? Doesn't everybody pray? Doesn't everybody worship this way? Doesn't everybody sing this way? No, they don't, right? They're not always prepared, okay? And that's the delicate balance of how do you figure this out with your children? How do you keep them protected? How do you keep them only hearing and seeing the things you want them to see and hear, that they need to see and hear, and keep them away from what they don't need to see and hear, but at the same time, have them prepared so they can survive, right? And so Jacob felt, I'm good as long as I'm around a bunch of holy people. I know how to do it. When my next door neighbor is Abraham and my other next door neighbor is Isaac and Becca's my mother, I'm pretty good. But I'm going to Laban and this Haran, this place of anger, this place of God's anger. I might need some extra help on how to deal with that. So he goes to Shem and Aver for that. He's going to live in this alien environment with corruption such as Laban, which is part of what Laban's name implies. He needed new information. He needed expert knowledge on how to maintain his integrity, his spirituality, his connection to God when exposed to more dubious and nefarious influences. In preparation for this challenge, Jacob spent 14 years in the tutelage of Shem and Aver. Inasmuch as it was God's design that Joseph live in Egypt, which also is a godless place, and his desires that Joseph would go there, dwell there, rise to power there, Jacob transmitted to Joseph all that he had learned during those 14 years. It was this special knowledge that would enable Joseph to remain a tzaddik, a righteous person, even in the decadent environment of Egypt. So what's the important message for us today? You think about it in terms of young people going off to college, where campuses are saturated with, well, the stuff colleges, campuses are saturated with. Or people go into modern business, the modern business world, into capitalism, which sadly is lacking in ethics and morality. How adequately are they prepared to withstand the influences that prevail in these environments? Coming from the saintly home of Isaac, Jacob nevertheless felt he needed 14 years of special preparation before he went into an alien environment. The question for us to ask is, do we spend even a fraction of that time in preparation? We do everything possible to immunize ourselves against physical diseases. How much do we immunize ourselves against the influences that threaten the health of our neshama? Do we do anything to prepare ourselves to diffuse the influence of street knowledge, if you will? Abraham Chorsky, the one we always begin with the nugget, right? In his commentary on this portion, he shared a personal story about some advice he received when he made it known that he was going to go study medicine to become a doctor. He's also a rabbi. He's a Torah scholar. So he's gone through yeshiva. He's gone through his like 14 years. He's Rabbi Chorsky. But he wants to become a doctor, a medical doctor. So he makes the announcement. And the following I'm about to read is an excerpt that he received from his mentor, his spiritual mentor. Here's the letter. Here's part of the letter. Quote, "Inasmuch as the environment that you will be in is essentially totally secular, with no faith, and with total abstinence of a sense of duty to God, there is a great danger that one exposed to this environment may suffer ideational and behavioral deterioration." Can you tell his mentor was a rabbi that was a psychologist? "The Rambam says that a person is deeply influenced by the people and the friends and those he works with and associates with. And so one needs much divine mercy so that one's faith and fear of God do not come to ruin as you enter into the medical world." The letter continues, "I believe it is essential to take protective measures to avoid being swept away by the secular current you are about to enter. It is therefore essential to, number one, set aside a minimum of 2 hours a day to study the Torah, and if possible, to find a God-fearing Torah scholar with a sound intellect to be your Torah study partner. Number two, to pray all the daily services, that is Shacharit, Mincha, Maariv, with a minyan, and at the end of the Amidah, that is the main prayer of each service, to pray intensely for divine protection against improper thoughts. Number three, go to the mikveh regularly. Immerse yourself. Number four, be most cautious in the proper observance of the Sabbath. The entire day of the Sabbath should be devoted to Torah and divine service. On the Sabbath, you need to avoid any kind of conversation that sounds like the weekday, and avoid reading anything such as newspapers or secular writings. The holiness of the Sabbath will be your protection for the rest of the week. Number five, to set aside no less than 15 minutes a day to study the work of Chassidut and Musar." You know, so we close the evenings a lot of times with Musar. Musar is ethical study, ethical applications of Torah. Chassidut is the study of certain rabbis such as Rabbi Nachman, the Baal Shem Tov, and like. The letter then concludes, "You should constantly remember that everything in existence, all senses and all intellect, are but a spark of the divine, and that without divine loving kindness, a person will be nothing at all. This should bring about in you some humility, which will lead you to fear of sin, which will lead you to piety, which will lead you to divine inspiration." That was the advice of his mentor before he entered a very secular school, a very secular mode of instruction, and a very secular career path. That these he needed to guard himself for this environment. Jacob and Joseph were both adequately protected for venturing into alien environments. Right? Isaac wasn't. Isaac, what's unique about Isaac? He never leaves the Holy Land, right? He never leaves the land. Jacob comes and goes because he can do this. Joseph is able to go into Egypt because he can do this. The Torah calls us to follow their example. We must not fool ourselves into thinking that we don't need to prepare to leave our bubble. Tamar's sacrifice. Sacrificing self rather than shaming the other. This goes back to our first portion about loving your neighbor as yourself. This is This is one of the ways we can love our neighbor. Right? Perhaps the most astonishing aspect of the story of Judah and his daughter-in-law Tamar took place after Judah was informed that the young widow had, as he was told, behaved loosely, right, and was pregnant. Judah meted out harsh punishment for this promiscuity. Genesis 38, verse 24, he says, "Take her out and have her burned." Confronted with such a severe sentence, Tamar could have easily pointed an accusing finger at Judah. After all, it was Judah who had made her pregnant. Not knowing the true identity of this prostitute that he had met on the road to Timnah, incredibly, Tamar, though, chooses to be silent. She chooses to be silent, right? When he says this to her, she could have easily just nailed him, right? But she remains silent. Only as she was led out to be executed did Tamar remark, rather enigmatically, I might add, Genesis 38, verse 25, "I am pregnant by the man who is the owner of these articles," i.e., anyone recognize this garment? That's a tikkun for Judah. For the Hebrew there is very close to the words used when the brothers spoke to their father Jacob and said, "Anyone recognize this girdle? This little piece of clothing?" Right? Tamar asks essentially the same question. It's a tikkun. It's an opportunity for Judah to repair what he damaged. It's an opportunity. He can take it or he can leave it. As we're going to see, he takes the opportunity. When Judah hears this cryptic message, again, he hears it on both levels, not only, "Dude, come on, I can nail you, but I'm not, we know, you know." He also hears the tikkun in there. He hears it on all the levels. He immediately realizes that her pregnancy is not the result of promiscuity, but is a form of levirate marriage. It was an act of a holy intent from Tamar, that Tamar was trying to consummate this levirate marriage, but she did it through deception because Judah would do it no other way. So why didn't Tamar save her own life by openly identifying her father-in-law, who happened to also be her judge? He's the one that sentenced her. Why didn't she save her life by naming him as the person responsible? The Talmud derives an amazing lesson from Tamar's selflessness here. It's in Tractate Berachot 43b. It says, "It is better to throw oneself into a fiery furnace than to shame another person in public, especially a righteous person." Now, we're going to unpack that phrase a little bit because it's better to throw oneself in a fiery furnace rather than shame someone. You need to interpret this in the same light of, if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off. No one really expects people to be going around without right arms and eyes and legs and limbs, right? It's hyperbole. Okay. This remarkable statement, though, does raise some issues. First of all, honor, is it really such an important thing? Tamar shows this great honor. It's better to throw oneself to fire first than to shame another person in public. The Talmud describes this as being one of the greatest honors you can have to do this. But the sages also teach in a vote in the Mishnah that the pursuit of honor and fame is an undesirable trait that can drive one from the world. So why was Tamar willing to die rather than embarrass her father-in-law? To answer the big question, we must distinguish between two types of honor. The first is illusionary. It's based on external acquisitions, such as wealth, position, fame, power, and so on. Pursuing this type of honor is certainly a negative trait, a mindset which can cause one to lose not only their way in this world, but in the world to come. But there is a nobler form of honor. There is a type of honor we are to seek. This honor is based on our awareness of our true inner worth as human beings created in God's image. Recognizing that all of us, because we are image bearers, have dignity. Therefore, there is an aversion to silliness and pettiness. This has the opposite effect than the superficial honor does. This awareness is the foundation of morality. It enables one to value the nobility of life, rooted in ethical and spiritual ideals. In an essay describing his generation's needs to deepen its appreciation of the spiritual side of the universe, specifically through not only the study of Torah, but through the study of the Torah's deeper, more mystical teachings, Rabbi Cook, who was the first chief rabbi of the modern state of Israel, noted a decline in humanity's awareness of their own dignity, of human dignity. He writes this in his work, Orot HaKodesh. It's in the first volume on page 96. As the world advances towards its superficial culture, it is simultaneously declining in its inner worth, in its understanding of the inherent human dignity that we all have. As it pursues things external, at the same time, it's inversely related. There's a relationship. As that increases, human dignity decreases, is what he's saying. This deterioration is due to the phenomenon that with the advance of society's external values, the eye is increasingly captivated by superficialities, and it learns to belittle inner awareness and human dignity. Due to this process, humanity's true worth continually dwindles. The world's redemption is dependent upon the revival of our inner perception and a regaining of human dignity. Human life has value only when it is accompanied by the recognition of one's inner worth and dignity. It is preferable to forfeit life in this world rather than publicly shame another person, permanently disgracing him and ruining his honor. Such a public defaming will bring about the loss of all value in living and a slow and degrading demise. In practice, however, it seems that one should not take such a drastic step. Talmud is not literally telling you to go jump into fire rather than shame someone. With time, a life lived fully can heal and can restore lost honor. Nonetheless, those with a noble and sensitive soul should feel that their own will to live is weakened. That's what the Talmud is getting at. It is weakened if their own survival must come at the expense of another's public disgrace and humiliation. That their life is lessened. That a part of them dies if they gain at the expense of someone else's humiliation. And for this reason, the sages do not write, one is required to throw oneself into the furnace. It says, rather, in kind of rabbinic idiom, it is better, which lets you know it's metaphor. It is better. In other words, it's how you should feel, even if in practice you do not go to that extreme. Now, I want to pair that with Judah's response to Tamar. Genesis 38:26. So after Tamar says she's about to be condemned and die, she just kind of says, anybody know who this is? Judah identifies the garment and says, she is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah. And he did not know her again. The Davidic dynasty of the kingship, and including King Messiah himself, comes from Judah. Not Joseph, but Judah. Whose action laid the foundation of true leadership here. The Torah relates that Judah was involved in a relationship which, if exposed, would humiliate him. The only person who could expose him was about to be executed, and his secret would have died with her. It would have been safe forever. What we have seen from modern leaders, whether it be executives, whether it be church officials, our congressmen, our senators, our presidents, denial, cover-ups, and failure to accept responsibility for one's actions. We have a legal system that purportedly says it's to ensure justice, to punish the criminals, to protect the victims. But if you really look at our system, it's more often than not seeking to absolve people from the consequences of their action. More often than not, it's, yeah, I did it, but let's negotiate down the punishment for it. It's really not about punishing the wrongdoer and protecting the innocent. It's about how much can I get away with, how little can I be punished for what I've done. Judah had the integrity and the courage to publicly confess his actions. Just a few moments of silence of his part would have prevented his actions from ever coming to light. Judah could have had a foolproof cover-up, but he chose to be truthful and to accept responsibility. This is the prime ingredient for leadership, and this is what makes him worthy to be an ancestor of the Messiah, that he has this type of leadership. There are numerous times in our own lives when we have the choice of accepting responsibility for our actions or denying them and covering them up. The message of the Torah is clear. Forthrightness earns one's honor and dignity. The temptation to cover up mistakes and justify oneself can be very strong indeed. And only with an unwavering dedication to the truth can one withstand the test of integrity. I want to share with you a story. In his younger years, Rabbi Yisrael of Salant began giving lectures on the Talmud in the city of Vilna. And all of the local scholars were enchanted with his brilliance. However, there were several people who became jealous of his intellect, and they sought to embarrass him. They engaged one of the foremost scholars in Vilna to challenge Rabbi Yisrael and to refute one of his interpretations from a passage of the Talmud. Rabbi Yisrael was able to successfully rebut all the scholar's objections. But one time, the scholar raised an objection to which Rabbi Yisrael could not rebut. Yisrael admitted that he had been mistaken, and he descended from his platform. He later confided to his close disciples that when the scholar raised the objection that, quote, "I immediately thought of five different ways in which I would have justified my position, and all five of them would have been accepted as an adequate rebuttal. However, I felt that none of these was in fact truth. Even though I would have won the argument, it would not have been truth. And therefore, the objection of the scholar that he raised was correct." Rabbi Yisrael continued, "Don't think for a moment that I wasn't tempted to simply defend my position." Been there where you're arguing and you finally realize you don't even know why it started. All you're doing is trying to prove you're right. You just want to be right. Rabbi Yisrael said, "Look, I could have won that argument. I'm better at arguing than these guys. I could have gotten them, but it really wasn't truth. But don't think for a moment I wasn't tempted to do that. I could further justify giving these rebuttals in order to preserve my dignity and authority as the head of the school." Right? He was like the president of the university. He was the Rosh of the yeshiva. "But I rebuked myself and said, Yisrael, where are your Musar principles? How can you justify defending something that you know isn't true? At that point, I admitted I was wrong and left the lectern. But it was not easy." The above incident that we just looked at from Rabbi Yisrael shows that he was no angel. Right? He had a yetzer. He wanted to burn those guys, and he could have burned those guys, and he struggled with that. He was no angel. He was superior to the angels. Angels don't have to struggle to overcome urges because their will and their yetzer are frozen. They're basically non-existent. Rabbi Yisrael is an example of what a human being can be if he's connected to God and Messiah and sincerely dedicates himself to be everything that he was created to be in the image of God. Musar moments. The need for spiritual mentors. Something I've talked about a lot at Torah Tuesday is the need for a teacher. And by that I don't mean someone that you've never met and listened to online. I mean a real flesh and blood teacher that you've seen face to face, that you have a relationship with, that not only do you know very well, but that they know you very well. A real teacher, a real mentor. You have to have that. The apostles had it, their disciples had it, so forth and so on. Shaul does this for Timothy, he does it for Titus, he does it for Epaphroditus, he does it for countless people. He teaches them what he learned from the master and what the master learned from his father. Right? It's very important you have a teacher. And when you find a teacher, it's important that you know who their teacher was. Genesis 37, verse 6, Joseph says to his brothers, "Please listen to this dream I had." Joseph's two dreams seem to convey the same idea. The reason for the apparent repetition is that they symbolize two different stages in the relationship between each generation and its leaders, its teachers, its mentors. The first dream involved sheaves of grain. Sheaves of grain are made up of individual stalks which grow discreetly from one another, each in its own groove. Binding them into sheaves symbolizes one of our chief tasks in life, gathering together all of our capacities and talents and uniting them together in the work of holiness. That is to experience the unity that our Messiah prays for in John 17. Take all these individual growing things and bundle them together into a unified group. Once we have become a sheaf, we need to seek guidance and inspiration from a Joseph, a spiritual leader, a teacher, a mentor. And as we mature spiritually, we will reach a higher level. And as we attain these higher levels of divine and messianic consciousness, we regain a part of our soul's original heavenly consciousness, and we begin to shine like a star, which is the second dream. So Joseph is wanting to teach them. This is part of their, "You arrogant, you know what, you're 17 years old, we're 38. Who are you to teach us?" But Joseph wants to teach them. First dream is about gathering them as individuals and having unity. Then they move from a sheaf to shine like stars. Right? Yet even on this level of stars, we are not to rely on our own achievements for inspiration, because this can lead to stagnation, complacency, our own arrogance. Rather, we must still continue to turn to our Joseph, our spiritual mentor, for further insight and inspiration. Emuna, relying on God's providence. Genesis 37:18, the text reads, "Before Joseph reached his brothers, they conspired against him. Although they neither intended it, nor did they foresee it, the brothers' actions led to Joseph's eventual rise to power and the survival of Jacob's entire family, including the brothers. Joseph's experience vividly demonstrates that whether we realize it or not, everything that happens to us is orchestrated by God for our benefit. This is what we call emunah. It is therefore foolish and unproductive to be angry with those who appear to be harming us, although that they may indeed be guilty for their wrong and their very sinful actions. Ultimately, we must be mindful that they cannot do anything to us that God does not allow or will. Rather, we should learn from Joseph, who repaid his brothers' evil with kindness, continuing to love them despite their hatred towards him. And in the end, he brings about their salvation." Caring for our inner beauty. Genesis 39 verse 6 says, "Joseph was beautiful in form and complexion." Whenever the Torah speaks about someone being beautiful, like Sarah or Rebecca, here it's Joseph. Joseph's physical beauty was a reflection of his inner spiritual beauty. That's really what it's describing. And what was beautiful about his spiritual being was his uncompromising dedication to the ideals of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. By virtue of his own spiritual maturity, Joseph was able to fulfill his divine mission of bringing others closer to God. You notice he does that throughout his life. He brings others closer to God. Like Joseph, we are all called upon to bring others closer to God. In order to succeed as Joseph did, we must try to imitate him, to be like him, to be spiritually beautiful in form and complexion. But this does not mean that we should wait until we achieve spiritual perfection before reaching out to others, because spiritual perfection is a relative thing. Compared to those who know less than you do, you are beautiful enough to inspire them. Nevertheless, we must also remember that if we neglect our own spiritual growth, others will take note, and they won't see beauty. And as a result, they will be less inclined to take the words we speak to heart. So, some Musar principles there for you. All right, well, we'll close there for this evening with Parashat Vayeshev. At the beginning, listen to some archives, different years when we've covered this parashat, we've focused on different components, including messianic implications and so forth. So check those out. Let us close with a blessing. Baruch atah Adonai, Noten HaTorah. Blessed are you, Lord, the giver of the Torah. Amen.